button. Button is pressed. Rob, is your button pressed?
If my button's totally pressed.
Is it an innie or an outie?
It's an innie, and it's very frustrated.
Why are you so frustrated? What's going
on? I should be very thankful for all the good service we've had from like Google Plus and whatnot. And we're just talking about some of the other awesome aspects of the Google ecosystem and whatnot. Just, I like doing our live casts, you know?
I do too. And I am very, very bummed out that we are running into this problem with the GTalk plugin. That's what I think is the culprit. For those who are listening to the show after the fact, thank you for downloading and listening, everybody. This is the Lean Into Art Cast, where two visual storytellers get together, and usually we try to walk around a difficult or compelling topic. And we usually start out with a curveball, where we try to stump one another with a question that is unanswerable, and then we go 1,000 feet up to examine our topic from a abstract point of view, and then we zoom in down the ground in order to get practical and useful and maybe share a few stupid helpy tips on how to actually put some of these abstract thoughts into practice. And then we close out with a takeaway on what we did this week. My name is Jersey Drozd.
And my name is Rob Stenzinger. That is quite a breath, Jersey. It's like our whole mission statement.
It all comes back to practicing talking like the Micro Machine Man when I was a kid. One of those things where at the time it just seemed like a dumb thing I was doing, but who knew it would actually become somewhat useful in my adult life. Google Plus. We've been doing these shows as a live stream on Google Plus, and the last couple weeks we've been running into this problem where I can hear you, Rob, but you can't hear me, but the YouTube stream can hear both of us. And I don't know what is going on with that. So some troubleshooting needs to be done. One of the problems with troubleshooting is we're both exceedingly busy right now. So, yeah, it's not been a situation where we could be like, oh, let's just take a couple hours on, Monday night to try to suss this out. We both got jobs.
But, yep. But
we'll hopefully get this straightened out pretty soon.
Yeah, I hope so. Why not mention it? I would say coming up fairly soon here, we haven't picked a date. We're actually going to a biweekly schedule, which I think that would help.
Yeah, putting out a show once every 2 weeks instead of four. So 2 times a month instead of 4 times a month is what it boils down to. And what does this mean? Are they giving it up? Are they pod fading? I got to get another thought on podcasting in general in a second here. But no, what this is about is us taking the time to actually reinvest some of our time back into the overall Lean Into Art project and not let the podcast be the sole thing that we do, but still meet weekly, but put work into other aspects of the site. So we'd still be working on it just as much as we were before, but we'd just be, maybe distilling a little bit of that content, producing a better product by giving ourselves more time to do it. Because if you've been listening to any of the 5x5 shows, some of them are coming to an end. And one of the things they've been talking about on some of those shows is how hard it is to come up with a weekly topic and talk about it with any kind of focus and intent.
Which ones are coming to an end?
Hypercritical.
Oh, yeah?
And Build and Analyze are both ending.
Oh, wow. I have not, haven't picked that up. That's some big news for me. Wow.
Those are my two Monday background noise music or background noise podcasts when I'm working. It's the to cleanse my palate before I dive into comics and art podcasts, because most of the time those guys are talking about stuff that I don't know anything about, like when they're talking about developing doing development for platforms and mobile operating systems. I'm like, I don't even know what this is, but this is my background talk radio. Like when I talk about the comic store that I grew up around, Levi's Bookstore in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. Whenever I'd go in there, he'd always have like political talk radio going on in the background, and it didn't even seem like he was listening to it. It always was like that crackly AM radio thing and just angry guys yelling at each other kind of thing. And I don't know. It became like the soundtrack for that place. And that was the soundtrack to me discovering a lot of what became my favorite comics. So I like having talk radio going on in the background.
That is super cool. And I have a lot of friends who love it. I need to give it a try because I love podcasts, but not as much into the talk radio. Every time I turn it on, it's the crackpot call-in hour. Yeah. And it's like the antidote for anything, any curiosity I ever had about it.
that's often my favorite stuff is the crackpot call an hour. Like when back when I was doing a lot of moving back and forth across the country, part of the fun was being in a U-Haul truck with no CD player, no tape deck. All you had was AM, FM radio. FM radio, forget about it. It's terrible. So we'd put on AM radio, and it's like, I want to find one of those conspiracy shows where they're talking about, like, I saw a shimmering light hovering above my house, and I know it was an Air Force vehicle that has a cloaking device on it, you know? I love that stuff. It's so much fun to listen to.
That's awesome. I think I'll give it a try again. Maybe I think if I look up at the stars, I think they're about in alignment where it's time.
Well, but I mean, that's the other thing is like with podcasting now, you really don't have to, you know. What was great is I used to do this. I used to cruise around TalkShoe. Remember TalkShoe? It's still around.
Yeah, TalkShoe.
The service through which you can do live podcasts with like callers. People can call in, and we used to do a live show on there years ago. But I used to just cruise through the archives to go, okay, what looks crazy? What looks like a crazy person's show? And I'll put that on in the background while I'm working. And I found this one where it was this guy who would just like put his, he would just be him talking by himself, and he would say like, well, I don't have much else to talk about today, so I'm just going to put the microphone next to my radio. You could listen to what local radio sounds like where I live. And he would just do that for like 10 minutes.
Okay.
What's this guy in Hawaii? And he'd be like, oh, here's the sound outside my window. You know, you hear birds or something like that. It was like public access TV radio. Ah, so much fun. Not always, though. Sometimes you come across a real stink bomb, you know, where it's somebody saying hateful stuff or... you know, they're angry in the bad way or crazy in the bad way, not crazy in the fun, harmless way, right?
Yeah, true. Okay, yeah, it's worth giving a shot. So pod fading and podcast.
Oh, yeah, I got off topic there. Sorry,
podcast decay half-life or something like that?
Yeah. So, no, it's called reallocating resources to make a better product is why we would be doing it. Now, we haven't picked a date on when we're going to do this. So probably my guess is it's going to happen sometime in December. Mm-hmm. But we will let people know via the Lean Into Art website. And, you know, who knows how long it'll last. It might be something where Rob and I are just like, oh, we got the itch. We got to do it weekly again. But for now, it seems like the prudent choice is to go to a biweekly schedule so we can recommit to making some more of the classroom content, the workshop content, and mm-hmm. and other things that we've always meant to do with the site since day one, you know?
But it's yeah, exactly.
Funny thing about life, you know, how, and I'm sure many of the listeners can sympathize with this, is that it's tough to have any kind of ambition and still try to hold down all of these biological Maslow's hierarchy of needs stuff that we have to do.
Interesting. Yeah. Maslow's, was it? It's pyramid of his pyramid of needs.
Yeah. The hierarchy of needs, right?
Yeah. The hierarchy of needs. Exactly. The, what starting with, survival,
and then prestige is in there someplace.
Yeah, I think that's third. I think after survival, it's sort of it's like shelter, and then sort of food and whatnot, mm-hmm. and maybe I don't know, something like another layer of survival, surviving comfortably, and then yeah, and getting then, some social some success, and then
very self-motivated emotional needs, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, prestige, effect, companionship or friendship or something along that line. But it doesn't even sound that good. It's purely animal, right? But anyway, yeah, that stuff gets in the way of all of our higher aspirations, but we can't ignore them because we are biological creatures after all. So, So before we dive into curveball, I do want to take one short digression. Rob, you saw Wreck-It Ralph.
I did.
After I hassled you last week. And I, you know what? In retrospect, I hate being that guy. You must see this movie. You must. You have to do it. Because you know what that does? It wrecks it for everybody. It makes them go like, God, what's so great about it? And then you go to it and you don't get to enjoy it as much because somebody played it up too big.
Sure. Or yeah, you can pre-take a stance and say, oh yeah, so great, huh? We'll see. No, you know, I believe it. It's funny. I'm often the person who, when I hear too many people like I throwing the recommendation at me, the same recommendation, I will subtly, you know, calmly resist it. But once in a while I miss out on some cool stuff. So I, you know what? I thought, why not? It sounds like a fun experiment. And I actually, my wife, myself and my daughter, we experimented and went as a family, with a young child. And if you're familiar with young children and movie theaters, you must understand the risks. Yeah. And it worked out. It was actually thoroughly engaging. And we paid for our child's whole seat, but she only needed the edge because she, as the monster truck saying goes, she just sat on the edge of that thing and was enamored.
Really? Wow. That's awesome.
So yeah. And I loved it. Very, very good story. Good.
Okay. So this is the only thing I need to know is when Ralph, and I'm not going to spoil anything for everybody, but when Ralph has to do that bad thing, mm-hmm. Vanellope, mm-hmm. you know, the scene I'm talking about where she's hung on a tree. How hard was that? How, especially, I was thinking like as a dad who has had to do things for the same reason, right? Mm-hmm. And not spoil anything, but there's a reason he has to do this bad thing that really hurts this person.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Was that hard to watch? Or
yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a monster, Jersey. That's what it, you know. Yes. And I got to see that played out as a, you know, as a character in that role, being a monster with the intent of trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
Just, it's a difficult and common position to be in as a parent, and especially as a mean dad.
I'm telling you, that was the part where I was really seriously biting my lip. I'm like, I'm not going to let it go. I'm not going to let it go. This is rough. This is really hard to get through. That and Homeless Cubert, that one for like, it surprised me by how emotionally affected I was by that. Like when it comes across Cubert and the other characters with the video game Unplugged, please help. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was well done. I mean, it may sound in an anecdote like it was cheese ball and whatnot. I thought it was a very genuine, well told story. And in it, there's a ridiculous amount of video games that now I want to play again, and also that I wish existed. And I actually happened to download the after tweeting as such last night about the commenting about the video games, because I actually saw it Friday night but didn't get around to mentioning it. But it was I downloaded two iOS apps that by Disney Interactive, and the free one's pretty good.
The Fix It Felix game.
Exactly, Fix It Felix, and then Wreck It Ralph is essentially a pack of games. I did not look. It's probably on Android as well, but.
I didn't look either, but I was just thinking about how what a missed opportunity that they didn't simultaneously release console games of the games that appeared in this movie. Like I so badly wanted to play Sugar Rush when I got out of that movie theater, and that was the first thing I did. Is I looked, okay, there's gotta be a Wii game or something. There's gotta be like Xbox something, and nothing. There's a game you can play in the browser on the website, but I just thought, wow, you know. And, with all the money they spent in licensing all those different properties to appear in that film, you couldn't put money into developing like even a kind of a cheap game, you know, but
sure. Yeah. There would be engines they could repurpose and whatnot. They could make, and you know, if they need a consultant, you know, I know someone, and they could repurpose engines. They could, I mean, there's a lot that they could do with the properties that they had, or even the ones that were invented for the film, like Sugar Rush and whatnot. Yeah. For instance, so like distributing a game on a platform is expensive because you have, there's a lot of, depending on the platform you're working on. So typically like Nintendo, PlayStation, I've never looked into, but, I've looked at, what is it? The URL, if you want to look at the Nintendo developer program and download their contracts and stuff, I think it's called just WarioWare.com. Hmm. And Yeah, you can go try to sign up, but then you'll notice it's essentially they have certain requirements for the size of your company and the kind of, you know, the type of entity. So you have to be incorporated and all the, it was all sorts of things and the expense of the development units and all that stuff. It's not a low bar to clear by design. Like what they're saying is like, we want to deal with companies who have a presence that could be, you know, you have a greater stake in this situation. And you have a longer term view, whatever that represents to Nintendo, it means most indie people, that's too high of a hurdle. But there's a lot of other paths. I mean, for instance, the iOS app, there's no reason they couldn't have made like a first class racer on the iOS platform.
Mm-hmm. Where and you could do competitive racing over Wi-Fi. Ugh, yeah. Forget about it. That'd be amazing.
Why not? I mean, actually, come to think of it, I don't know. Is there like a first class, clear winner, awesome kart racer for iOS?
I haven't looked to see that. That was the funny thing is that this is the first time where I was really seriously looking for that kind of a game. It's not something I normally go hunting down. A, I don't have much time to play games, and B, I never had a huge amount of interest. I'd play Mario Kart whenever, you know, if I'm going to be around a bunch of friends, but it's not something where I'm like, ah, I got to log in a couple hours on Mario Kart, you know? So it was an opportunity where they built, see, this is something I've railed on a bunch of times in the past. And I don't know if this is interesting to anybody, but it seems like this is kind of tertiarily related to talking about storytelling is I always gravitated towards play as a child and as an adult that had some kind of investment to it, some kind of story to it. And I'm not just talking about like, oh, well, this is a branded thing. This has Transformers on it. Therefore I like it. But those Transformers movies that Michael Bay made, can't watch them. If it doesn't have compelling characters, I'm not interested in the thing as much. But if you make a compelling character, if you make a compelling backstory, if you get me hooked emotionally somehow to the world beyond this, because I'll admit it, if I was playing Sugar Rush, and if I was playing Vanellope von Schweetz in the game, there'd be a part of me that's thinking Ultron-like and thinking like, she's really in there, you know? There'd be a tiny part of me that's thinking that, right?
Yeah, what a great reference too. Like Tron, another, probably one of the first strong movie tie-in games, come to think of it.
Yeah. And to this day, whenever I play that, there's a stand-up arcade cabinet at Pinball Pete's here in Ann Arbor, and it's there, and every time I play it, that's what I'm thinking. When I'm playing the light cycles, I'm picturing some poor little dude in there. So they got me hooked emotionally. They got me invested in the story, and it makes me, to this day, chuck quarters at this machine that's how many years old?
So. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the ideas behind a workshop that I do, actually, making video games from your comics, where you can have a... So think of the game Asteroids. I know it's a classic. It's been around forever, what have you, but then... what is it really? So you have a triangle shape. You've got little dots that shoot out of the triangle. You've got circles. Yeah. So what does it mean? Like, I guess there's some energy there. You know, triangles might hate circles, right?
Yeah.
But it's not that compelling in and of itself, unless you think of it as you have a spaceship full of explorers who are trapped in an asteroid belt. They're in the vacuum of space. They have to survive. And now you have something that matters more. And they're dealing with the literal crushing force with this tiny, fragile ship and trying to navigate. And they've got the guns and whatnot. And they've got hyperspace. But there's a lot of risk in that. You know?
And you have the Jaws music playing the whole time, right?
Oh, yeah. Right? I forgot about that.
Building the Dread. Bum, 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 bum. I mean, that was the first thing. The first time I played Asteroids when I was a little kid, that was the first thing that grabbed me. Because when you play Pac-Man, there's no music. There's just the waka 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 sound and the ghost, the eerie ghost sound. But there's no soundtrack. When I played Asteroids,
it's urgent. Actually, come to think of it,
oh, you're right. There's a yeah, and then there's like a
woo woo woo.
Yeah, the sirens are playing, right? but with Asteroids, there's this kind of like dreadful Jaws dirge playing the whole time, right?
Oh yeah, that's actually like taiko drummers and like, you know, rice fields or whatnot, or marching off to battle.
Yeah.
You know, doom 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 doom, like all of a sudden getting more and more. I don't know.
We should do a whole episode on, you know, the cultural references of video games.
All right. Yeah.
But actually, yeah, $10 making video games from Comics Workshop. If you enjoyed this little segue into talking about video games and storytelling, you know, I actually actively encourage you to check out Making Video Games from Comics. I've seen this workshop live. I participated in the online workshop. It's really good, and it's a steal at $10, which leads me to, we'll talk more about Wreck-It Ralph later, I suppose. Curveball time. We're only like 20 minutes over for curveball time, but let's dive into curveball because we have one.
We do. We have an email from a listener that we actually got an email directly from, so I don't know if we can read their name, come to think of it.
Oh.
It's a direct email. They didn't, they say thanks for the show and stuff, but they did not say, okay, so we have...
can we just say the person's first name? That'll preserve their identity as long as we don't use their last name, right?
Sure, sure. Okay, so we have an email from Ashley. And she asks, this is a great curveball. How do you maintain an audience other than creators? A lot of the conventional tips for extra content, how-to videos, creative process, things, etc., seemed like they would attract mostly other creatives. I'm still at the product stage, not marketing yet, but it's something to keep in mind as I progress.
Jill said one just for you. Do we want to just save that for after we respond to the
sure.
first paragraph?
Let's see. Maybe let's see if we have time for this, but we can do a quick flyby. I don't know, since you mentioned it. So also, you know, just for Rob, which I'm just going to say it's actually for Jersey too. Cause I got the invitation, but then I extended it. So you're invited, Jersey. Have you ever made any apps that use RevMob? If so, how do they fare? How did they fare? I'm trying to figure out whether to release a PC game or a free game with ad integration, and cutting through all the hype around apps is proving difficult.
That's what I'm more interested in.
Well, cool. Let's take a swing at both of them.
Okay. Let's do the last one first because I'm really interested in your thoughts on this.
Mm. So, I mean, I've done some research into RevMob, but not a lot. I have thought at a various times about adding ads to, well, both my comics and apps. I mean, Guitar Fretter, I had an assumption that I would probably release two versions. But there's this little thing, this little creative property that I fell in love with that never, ever used ads. And I kind of respect them a lot for that. HomestarRunner.com. They never, ever used ads, ever. And there's something about a trade-off that it got me thinking. And I know it can work well with some projects. For instance, actually, the Wreck-It Ralph I downloaded is ad-supported. You know, Disney Interactive is doing an ad-supported app, right? I mean, think about that. Think about the scale of their team. I have not totally analyzed it, but if you probably do a little research, a little bit of, you know, web searching, hit LinkedIn, and, you know, you probably can see that. That's a trick I use, by the way. Sometimes I look up companies on LinkedIn and see how many employees they have and stuff in my spare time for some reason. No, I do that when I'm doing diligence on a company. I bet they have a pretty sizable team and they're choosing to adopt ads. It's likely not a bad path, right? So this is for me, but I think about what that means when I pair my creative voice along with someone else's unfiltered, uncurated creative voice, where a lot of ad networks, you have very little control as far as what appears next to your work. Some you have more control. So like Project Wonderful and whatnot, which there is no game or mobile platform Project Wonderful that I know of. But it's been a while since I've checked out what they're up to. So maybe.
But
maybe
I'd be surprised if they weren't looking into that if they're not there already. But yeah.
So they might be. Who knows? They've been doing cool stuff for years. So I wouldn't be surprised. I just saying that I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So I've always had that debate as far as putting other people's marketing voice next to what I'm doing, right? And I think about, because there's implicit endorsement there. And I guess it depends on how comfortable you are with that. some people, like I can say that and there may just be a big old, so what, Rob? And sure. If that's the case, try it, you know?
Right. I mean, it depends also on, you know, I guess the users that are using it, because, you know, I hear from a lot of people, like, I don't mind ads at all because I don't even notice them anymore. You know, I got all sorts of iOS ads that are or apps that are ad supported. Don't even think twice about it. And then I find other ones where the ads are very cleverly placed so that it's like right under the key navigation functionality. So you wind up accidentally clicking ads a lot, you know, and then like, oh, that's cute. You got me. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I guess, or if you're worried that your audience might be too sensitive to that. And yeah, I think you're right. That's another concern, that it's one of the many, many, many things you got to weigh, is that implicit endorsement. Even though it's not an endorsement, it's still running next to your thing. This is what stopped me from running a lot of ads on any of my sites. The two things are, A, that endorsement aspect. I don't want to have somebody, and especially like when Project Wonderful, where there's like scads of jokes about poorly designed ads in Project Wonderful, right? But you've got some granular control on that. But then also, it's like, I think about scale. You know, it's like with the Disney Interactive thing, it's like, it seems like, that you're hitting a broad base with that. A lot of people are probably downloading that app. That's a lot of eyeballs, as they say in the industry. Whereas if my website was an app, and if I looked at my web stats, and I, you know, my personal site doesn't get that much traffic, then all I've got is the Project Wonderful placeholder ad that says your ad could be here for one penny, you know, which says another thing, you know. So I don't know. That's why I wanted to get your take on it.
Let's see. So yeah, I mean, I've played around with this stuff a bit. I mean, I have this debate as far as like, if you're looking at third party providers for high score systems and achievement systems, and if you're doing multiplayer and matchmaking, I mean, there's third party providers that will do this for you, but will often include them using your app. And this isn't me vilifying it, but like what they're doing is they have your app is a sales platform for not just ads, but like it's kind of an embedded app that's almost like a mini, you know, cross-selling store thing where that could bring people either directly to their app store or help them get affiliate links to, you know, gain affiliate credit for linking someone to an app store if they purchase the app.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I mean, and on one hand, you know what? It's a lot of work to build these things yourself. Like, for instance, the value that they're providing is huge with, you know, negotiating and handling the transactions with the ad space buyers, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, handling all the storage of the ads and the logic that serves them up. And they're doing a lot of work there. And then that same thing extends to if you're using third-party multiplayer matchmaking or leaderboards and all that too. That's a lot of work to build.
Yeah.
And to make secure.
Oh, huge, yeah.
Huge pain when it comes to that, to avoid you know, people cheating the system. So how did they fare? So I have not analyzed them in particular, but yeah. So I don't really have a strong opinion on RevMob themselves. They seemed legitimate, but I mean, I would say that would be a matter of when you sign up. I recommend, you know, I know it's painful, but read the fine print.
Yeah. Okay. Well, cool. So do you want to take on the other one? How do you maintain an audience other than other creators? How do you prevent yourself from being the creator's creator?
First, form a learning network. Wait.
Yeah. How do we maintain an audience other than other creators? Man, you know, sometimes it seems like those are the only people who actually pay any attention to my stuff. But then that's an old joke, too, is like, who reads webcomics? Other webcomics creators, right? I'm sure there's some non-practitioners who enjoy my stuff.
Guaranteed. There are web comics I can think of two in particular, but I'm trying to remember their names. But they're almost really passionate readers where they'll adapt. I noticed them, you know, over the years on Twitter, connecting up with them, and they'll follow comics and they don't make them, but they do a lot to promote and share them and you know, discuss their excitement about the medium. As far as not attracting, the main thing I've ever done that hasn't attract that's brought me to a different audience is, making an app. So that worked. Conventions, honestly, come to think of it.
How to videos, creative process, things, etc. You know, not to overly defend that, but here's the other thing is I got to think that kind of behind the scenes stuff is interesting to non-practitioners, to some non-practitioners as well. If we're going to be overly diagrammatic and say that you've got, you know, casual fans, and then you've got fans who are probably, you know, aspiring creators themselves, and then you've got fellow peers, professionals, right? So in that middle ground is this group of people who are flirting with the idea of doing the stuff themselves and are a fan of you both because, actually, this is something where I've got a lot of mixed feelings on, is the fan where they're becoming kind of a connoisseur and they can appreciate it a little bit more than the people who do the 11 o'clock news can, right? But they don't know how to do it well yet, right? That's the person I'm talking about. Man, they're going to gobble that stuff up, and that makes them into almost like a super fan because they're appreciating you on multiple levels. But also, I think, like, you know, I got friends who don't watch DVD extras, and then I've got friends who do. I have no interest, zero interest in ever making a film. I do not care one whit about making a film. But, man, I love listening to commentaries from creative people, you know? I mean, granted, I'm a creative person myself, so, yeah, there's, like, professional overlay. But you know what? You know what my favorite audio commentaries on a film is? Number one with a bullet, actually, would be the audio commentary on It Came from Outer Space, 1950s science fiction film with Richard Carlson. And it is a movie historian who does the audio commentary. It's nobody who worked on the film. And it's just, I forget the guy's name. It's like Tom Wheeler or something like that. I might be mixing up with somebody else. But he does this mile-a-minute breakdown of the history of the film while simultaneously responding to stuff that's happening in the film. So he tells all these stories about Ray Bradbury, and then I forget the name of the director, I think it's Jack Arnold, and all the negotiations that went into the different screenplays that were written, so about Richard Carlson's alcoholism and noticing weird things like, why is his pipe upside down in this scene? Like, there's a scene where Richard Carlson gets off of the helicopter and he's got a pipe in his mouth, but the pipe's upside down. You know, it has nothing to do with me getting, you know, creative fuel of, oh, that's how they do that sound effect. That's how they did that special effect. It's more of just film history, right? And that's interesting. So I wouldn't utterly discount. I mean, I think Ashley's right that how-to videos, creative process stuff does tend to appeal to people who want to do that stuff. But I think it's also interesting extra stuff that is worth capturing as a fringe benefit of just making the stuff anyway. If you're already making the stuff and you've got the camera there, just put it on you and record it, put it on YouTube, because that's one more way for people to find out more about your stuff, right? Whether whether it's a fellow creative or somebody who just aspires to creativity or somebody who tripped upon it by accident. So anyway, I don't know if all those words added up to anything, but I do think there is some value to that as well.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I just want to echo this. I don't mean to just do my Rob paraphrasing of what Jersey just said. To just say, I was listening.
Rob's distillation of my chaos thoughts.
There is a casual audience that does really enjoy the behind the scenes work, and I don't know. I mean, I'm this is armchair teaching theorist, whatever, but like I think part of that is learning is fun, and that is another product. I mean, so you're making the product, but there's some of the raw materials that you have to create another product is the experience of making the primary product. And in other words, you know, if you're making a comic, you got the how-to of how you are choosing to make that comic. Yeah, aficionados, it's certainly, you know, practitioners at various levels are going to find that interesting. But if that product in and of itself feels fun to read, because, well, learning is fun, right? Yeah. And that is another, you know, that could be someone's primary form of entertainment or service that you're providing to them. And they'll read the ads or whatever on your site because of that, possibly.
Well, and let's also talk about ad integration. There's another way, and this is like both being really forthright with your audience, but also thinking like in crude marketing talk is, and this is something that I don't do enough on my own, but I try to, is sharing behind the scenes stuff that isn't creative process stuff, but more like inspiration stuff. Here's a thing that I really, really love, and this inspires my work. And we've talked about this before. I mean, this is why I do those occasional warm-up sketches based on, you know, 80s cartoon properties or 80s and 90s cartoon properties. And I'll do a blog post of it. It's just to warm up my hand before I start drawing. You know, I'm going to get started doing some inking today, and I got to limber up. I'm going to do a quick sketch that I don't care about. I'm going to draw a guy from, you know, the Filmation Ghostbusters series. And then I've got a blog post where I can go, man, I love the Filmation Ghostbusters. And here's an embedded YouTube video of the introduction 30 seconds, right? Which gives me more, you know, you think about this stuff. It gives you more Google juice. I get a lot of search traffic from people looking for information on these different cartoons that I've drawn characters from. And you know what? People do a search for Hordak, Masters of the Universe. They find that Hordak sketch. And then suddenly, boom, there's like a ton of page views that day of people going through my archives of He-Man character redesigns. So there's also extra content that you can make in just sitting down and thinking about what is the inspiration behind my project, and how can I have fun with that to create extra content to drive more people in who are interested in that stuff. And then the idea is, if they're interested in that, they're probably going to be interested in your book too. Not all of them, but a small number of them will be. It will be a way to net in some new readers by virtue of the fact that if you're inspired by that, there's probably some of that essence in your story that other fans of that stuff will respond to. This is the whole thing that they do at conventions where people have sketches of Aquaman on the table and then their book is next to it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a, it's funny. In a way, it is, I cannot remember, is it called positioning? I mean, it's in a way, it's a marketing technique. And in a way, it's also, you're sharing an inspiration, something that caused and informed some of your creative process in some small way, at the very least. And at the same time, you're associating you and, your product with this other thing. One way or the other, they're now juxtaposed, where if you don't talk about it, it's not on the site. You talk about it, now you're positioning, well, here's me and my work, and hey, this is Masters of the Universe, and this is, or, you know, this is Filmation's Ghostbusters cartoon series.
Yeah. Right.
And yeah, now they're positioned together. And then that's actually one of the things where, I'll just say it, whatever. That's been one of my forms of stage fright or whatever in dealing with posting comics, where I was chicken to post, like, I put a reference to like an Iron Maiden song or whatever. And then like, I'm like, oh, I should post the Groove Shark audio. You know, I should totally do that. And then we go like, nah, cause I'm feeling like I'm putting my work like right alongside their work and saying like, yeah, it's the same. Or, you know, it wouldn't be what I'm intentionally doing, but that's what the bad Rob in my head is saying I'm doing. Just owning up to something.
No. That's interesting. I'm trying to think if I ever felt that way in the past. Because I know that I only started doing this kind of thing in the last couple of years. But I don't think it was a situation where I was... I've got to think, if you feel that way, probably a few other people feel that way too. And what I'm interested in is you think anybody else would call you out on that? And if they did, what would be your response? Okay, so let's role play real quick. I'm on your site and I see that here's Rob's comic, and I'm reading it. It's passable. It's readable, at least. I can tell what's going on in the panels. And oh, he's got an Iron Maiden reference, and there's a blog post under here where he's got the audio from Groove Shark, and he's talking about how much he likes Iron Maiden. Oh, I'm going to write an email. Dear Rob, I just taking time out of my day to tell you that I'm most displeased with your self-association with Iron Maiden. I happen to love Iron Maiden, and you, sir, are no Iron Maiden. the end, all caps. What's your response?
Up your irons, pal.
Because anyway. you're coming at this with like the best of intentions, right? You're just saying, "Hey, I dig this thing."
Exactly. It's being silly. It's overvaluing a certain small risk of internet negativity, right? Yeah. I mean, it's possible. Absolutely. What you described, I would argue, is ridiculously feasible, and I would say I've seen a little bit of that.
Yeah.
And I won't say any more of that. But yeah, but even then, so what? Really?
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, you're right.
You get to like what you want to like, and you get to talk about what you like, you know? And as a matter of fact, I'm gonna reference the Spark podcast again. I know I've brought this up in the past, but the latest episode of the Spark podcast, I thought of you, and, uh-huh. and not for this reason until now, but she's talking with a guy who is, the topic is online education. And what online educators can learn from heavy metal forums. and this guy's talking about pedagogical theory and Cannibal Corpse in the same sentences, you know. And I thought, wow, Rob's not alone. There's other guys like him out there. Hyper-intellectual guys who also like to rock out. But one of the things he talks about in there is that one of the things we can learn from as online educators or anybody who's interested in online education is that it's not a democratic process, that there's like this sort of self-selection that happens, and there's this proving of oneself that you have to do. You have to earn your stripes to be able to be the expert on this particular topic. And if you just join a forum and say, "Hey, you know, I'm here to tell you that the latest Cannibal Corpse sucks," there's going to be an attitude of, "Who's this guy? You know, he doesn't have skin in the game like we have because we've been here a long time." And once you've earned your stripes and proven yourself through lots and lots of discourse and stuff, and he's sort of talking about not just metal culture, but like the culture of the internet and internet forums.
There are meritocracies. A lot of forums have a karma system. So the karma system of points pertains to, Stack Overflow. I don't know if you come across Stack Overflow that much, Jersey, but it's essentially a giant community and huge success story where, a lot of bulletin board systems, online communities were having a hard time. And they essentially did a bit of design with game intent, otherwise known as gamification, but I'm now terming it as designing with gameful intent. And they tried to create incentive around organizing topics and rewarding people based on how many posts they do and based on how many positive feedback instances and negative feedback instances and all these kinds of things, and how people act and behave. They essentially created metrics and measurements and ways to, you know, give points around all these things and grow an incredibly robust system that's now been cloned to like all sorts of other problem domains, like not just programming is Stack Overflow, but then there's others like there's one for music and there's one for making video games and there's one for, you know, not just the interests I'm interested in. That is quite the filter I use, but yes, other people's interests are out there too.
So the point is that, and this is something, you know, I struggle with myself, Rob, all the time, is that, you know, I try to keep things in the perspective of, it's like, okay, I'm going to back up real quick as I try to build this point. We're all just dudes. And when I say dudes, I mean that in the gender neutral sense of dudes.
Yep. Male dudes and female dudes.
Right. Just doing our best to work our hustle and try to do something that is creative and of merit, right? And we're in that, we can't escape that world. That is the window through which we're staring at the rest of the world. That's our place where we're standing, right? And then you have to remember, what do I look like from the outside every once in a while? And sticking with it and just being persistent and consistent in the kind of stuff you create. And when I say consistent, I mean consistent in the sense of finishing and delivering, not consistent in terms of quality, because there's ups and downs always in quality, and there should be. But that alone gives you that kind of like that those karma points and it pushes you through that meritocracy so that when you do say, hey, I dig Iron Maiden, you get to say that. Even if you don't have the karma points, you get to say that. This came up with that whole fake geek girl thing from a while back, which I think I talked about in last episode or the episode before. Mm-hmm. It was last episode. You know, and it's like, you know, we get to decide what we like and we don't have to answer to anybody for that. So, you know, if I were to run across somebody who's just this is something Casey Van Heist has said to me many times. I would rather talk with somebody who's really crazy passionate about bottle caps than talk with somebody who is, you know, like a well buffed and polished person who has no passion in their life. You know, and that I'm paraphrasing largely what Casey said. So I think the key is, and this is the thing I always say to people when they ask me talk about public speaking, is I said, look, I don't think I'm the smartest guy in the room, but there's no way, I'm not even close, you know? I am definitely in the bottom half of the middle tier of the smart meter, but I'm really crazy excited about it. And I think that that excitement about something is my edge that makes what I say and do hook or catch on with certain people. So I think as long as you've got that, like this is the, here's the three things I love about Iron Maiden. And even if it's not well written, but that energy and intensity is there, then you get to say that, you know. I think the only way you don't get to do that is if you're faking it in order to try to get Google juice. The Google juice is just a byproduct of the enthusiasm, right? But if you're doing it just for the Google juice, like I'm going to mention Iron Maiden 6 or 7 times in this because my SEO friend told me that you got to use the word comics, Iron Maiden, and, you know, and click here and make sure to have everything paginated onto multiple pages so there's lots and lots of page views so my ad guys get really happy. That kind of stuff you see right through. But somebody who's just like really excited about something, that regardless of how rusty or creaky it is, it usually, you know, it works, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it totally makes sense. And it resonates with a lot of you know things I've encountered. The emotional content statement that I can't find from Bruce Lee, it comes to mind. Mm. You know, emotional content is what matters. What people connect with, people I think it had to do with someone was interviewing him, and it had to do with sometimes when people would see his movies either poorly subtitled or poorly dubbed or what have you. And he was saying it's the emotional content that's resonating with the audiences. And this is my bad paraphrasing of Bruce Lee, but, yeah. Anyway, emotional content.
You know, we've been at this 47 minutes. I just want to stay on this. I think Ashley just hijacked our show. But that's because she gave us such good food for thought.
Exactly. Good job, Ashley. I did want to get to this topic. I mean,
well, we could do it next time because then it'll give us more time to think about it. It gives us time for that to percolate. But I do enjoy when a listener or a student in my classroom just hacks the thing. You know, you talked about that at Kids Read Comics this past year when one of the kids hacked the assignment and found their own way into it and demonstrated their own learning in their own way. Oh, that's the best. And if somebody can give us a question that gets us so excited that we forget to do what we were supposed to do, that's a good thing.
Yeah, exactly. If we were gamifying this, it would there'd be some solid pointage there.
but back to this whole thing about, like, you know, extra content stuff, like what other things people can do. I mean, I think, like you were pointing out, an app. Something that other comics creators have played around with is doing animation or cartoons, like limited animation to go along with their stuff, right?
Mm.
Using things like Toon Boom Studio. I think a game would be awesome. You know, that was like when I was doing the front online as a webcomic, that was the thing I had in my back pocket. It's like, oh, wouldn't it be awesome to make an Atari, you know, 4-bit style game based on the Taz game? Did you ever play that?
No, I never played Taz.
But you know what I'm talking about? It was an Atari 2600 game, and it was all you were was the tornado, Tasmanian Devil in tornado mode. So it was just like this really crudely drawn tornado, and there were like six horizontal levels, and moving across those levels at different speeds and in different directions were various foods. But every once in a while was a dynamite stick. And so it was to navigate and eat the foods, but avoid the dynamite stick. And I thought, boy, wouldn't it be fun to do something like that simple, but just with my characters instead, right? So even something simple and dumb like that, that's just like what Homestar Runner does, where they would just embed little games like the old Trogdor game, or what was the one, the 3D vector game that they did?
Oh, yeah, Your Head Explode.
Yeah, Your Head Explode.
I don't know. Yeah, I can't remember what that one was called, but yeah. But so tying in it, so it's interesting. There's a few different forms that we're talking about. So think about let's go back to heavy metal. Okay, Rob.
For asking.
A lot of heavy metal was marketed very effectively by having incredibly awesome artwork. And hiring artists that not all of them worked for the band. I mean, so there were some cases like the dude from Voivod, his album covers. I mean, he's an artist in the band. I think Tool, one of those guys, is a visual artist, or all of them. I mean, I think they met in art, some kind of art school. I'm not a great historian of metal, but. There's a good podcast out there to check out that I haven't kept up with lately, the Requiem Metal podcast.
Yeah.
By Mark Rudolph and Jason
Hundy.
There you go. Excellent show. Great if you want to get into the nerdy aspects of studying metal history and also hear some great music. But a lot of metal was it was like this. These images were the first impression that people connected with. And so having like a strong feeling about, for instance, the futuristic Eddie character from Iron Maiden, the mascot on the cover of Somewhere in Time, which looks like a landscape from Blade Runner. And you've got this laser totem, like ripped off skin. Maybe he's undead. Totally tough, crazy looking, yet techno demon like guy.
That's a good description, actually.
It was a pretty compelling image, and the color scheme and whatnot, it popped. I mean, like seeing that little cassette on the shelf, I'm like, yep. Or I'm just going to say another one too, like Yngwie Malmsteen, Rising Force, with his hand rising out of the fire as a guitarist who just got out of a guitar lesson. Going into the the music store was, seeing that thing on the shelf, I'm like, yep, that looks like a good idea. I never heard it before. Anyway, and so other games do this with music. Music soundtracks, depending on where your interests lie, if you're into dance music or whatever, there's a lot of cross pollination there. And different mediums can support and broadcast and advertise for one another. So maybe there's a sort of a multimedia strong connection, whether maybe you have that interest or you have a friend or that'd be whatever, willing to collaborate on something, or
right,
can jump to a different medium.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that the trick is, and this is where I haven't been utterly successful in this yet, is finding the medium that can best support the intellectual property in a way that makes sense, right? Like, you don't want to just take something and just squish a game into it, or you don't want to just take something and squish an animated short into it. It's like the closest I got was when I got my brother to do the theme song for the Silver and the Periodic Forces comic. And it was exactly right on the nose, that 80s Saturday morning cartoon intro music. And I actually found, or rather he found, an unused take where we actually put a VO to it, a voiceover read of the introduction page of the story, like the classic cartoon intro where, like, thundering across the stars to save the universe from the monster mines.
Cool.
But I'll have to see if he can give it to me. And it actually held up pretty good when I went back and listened to it. But anyway, the step I didn't take was actually doing an animated intro. But then when I looked at the work that would have to go into it to make it look as good as I would want it to, so it didn't just look like a crude Flash animation, I realized that I just didn't have time to do that, you know. So, but yeah, you don't want to just squish it into another medium just for the sake of it. But the trick is to think about what other medium would it work in.
Here's
a good example, Rob. You sent me the link yesterday to the Sugar Rush 1997 commercial, quote unquote. And this is something they've been doing with these animated films for the last couple years, which I think is just dynamite, just so clever. They did it with Toy Story 3, where they did fake 80s commercials for these old toys and even put in the VCR tracking lines on it to make it look absolutely authentic. And so, yeah, right? They make a... Oh, this is what the new media hipsters are calling transmedia, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's in some ways, I mean, the alternate form of your product doesn't have to be that much different than the primary form. So there was footage from the movie Wreck-It Ralph in the short, the fake commercial for. Whatever that guy's name was, the arcade owner, huh?
Oh, yeah.
There's the arcade owner's character, his business. That's who the commercial's for. It's for Sugar Rush, but it's like Sugar Rush at, you know, it's kind of funny when you break down what the commercial's really about. But
yeah,
it's fun anyway. Yeah, and it's they got a lot of reuse. There's some new footage there, but there's some stuff from the movie. Mm-hmm.
That's the other thing, is if you can get double duty out of it too, right?
I experimented for a while. I was working on doing a reading performance of my comics, and then to do that over an animated, and I experimented with a few different forms of this, but essentially panning through the comic. The comic page, we're essentially doing my own sort of camera tracking through the not adding any other animated elements other than the traveling path as I narrated it through the page.
Okay.
Which I'd be curious what your thoughts are on that. I think I had a nightmare that involved some threatening words from you. That's where I stopped that dream. But no.
That's a different thing. That's a different That's a performance. You're turning the work into a performance at that point, and that becomes a new medium in and of itself when you do that.
And I'm referring to the Jersey's traditional dislike for mixing animation and comics.
Yes, I get really itchy about the idea of taking a comics page and blasting it into pieces and looking at it out of context of the other panels, which is what some of these phone reading apps do. Like for reading comics on your phone, it'll be like, well, I'm just going to show you panel one, and then you tap it or do something, shake it or whatever, and it zooms to panel two. I'm like, well, it's not really comics anymore. It's images in a sequence, but that context, especially when the page was designed for that context, matters a lot. There's a whole other, rabbit hole we could go down in terms of that, but that's just the short version of where I get kind of itchy. But what you're talking about is a completely different thing, because you're talking about transcending, or not transcending, but shunting aside to a different medium altogether and turning the same work into a performance piece, which actually, I don't know if I told you about this or not, Rob. Stop me if I told you about this. I've been kicking around this idea for, and this is based on something John O'Ballier pitched at me. He said, private messaged me a while back, said, like, you know, we should be looking into public readings of comics in the Ann Arbor area, because like something like he and I and many other cartoonists in the area have been trying to get a scene going here in Ann Arbor. But, we've really been focusing on like making events. Let's get together and just draw together. Right? Which is awesome, and a lot of people turn out for this, but it's not getting the general public to stop by and watch, because that's not that much fun for a passerby to watch somebody draw, right? There's always that weird awkwardness of, am I being too close? Am I interrupting something, et cetera? So Jono, I think, very astutely pointed out that, like, well, a public reading and this is something Dave Roman and Raina Telgemeier have talked about on other shows that I've done with them, is a public reading is something that the general audience can participate in and not feel the pressure of having to actually contribute to it. They get to just experience it. You're turning comics into a live stage show. So I was at Ignite 7 in Ann Arbor, Ignite Ann Arbor 7, and they brought in a guy, I forget his name, but he did the last talk, I think, and I think he's from The Moth, if I'm not mistaken. He's one of the guys behind The Moth, or he works on The Moth, that storytelling show, right? You've heard of it, right?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's an NPR thing. But he did this talk, which was less of a talk, but more of a story. And it was this very kind of abstracted story. But the images, he was timing his story to the images, because in Ignite Talks, the images change every 15 seconds or so. So it was interesting to watch him work, to see him pacing out his tale so that when, you know, he was treating the slides as page turns, right? Mm-hmm. And that got me to thinking, well, wouldn't it be interesting to do a public comics talk like an Ignite talk, but it's comics focused or visual storytelling focused. And you have to tell a story about not just do a public reading, but do a story of sort of behind the scenes of the scene you're going to do a public reading of. So you have to start off with an initial talk about this is the story that happened to me that inspired or had a direct effect on the scene we're about to read together, right? But you also have to compose your slides to tell that story along with you. So it's participating in what makes comics so great, the immediacy of visual juxtapositions, but the juxtaposition is your voice and the image on there. So it's not just a bullet-pointed list of, I was born in Miami and then I moved to Saskatchewan, right? As you're telling the story, you're using the images to visually convey the emotional data and punctuate and emphasize and flesh out things that are nonverbal or really kind of underlining the verbal parts, et cetera, the kind of things you're supposed to do in comics. And then it concludes with, after you do your fun little talk, it concludes with a public reading of one of the pages or a scene from your book. Mm. So now the public is to participate in what makes comics so great. They are sort of getting trained into how comic storytelling works through the initial talk, plus getting a backdoor entry into being emotionally invested in why they should sit down and participate in the scene they're about to watch. As I was telling this to Jono, he's like, you're going to have to write this out. He's like, you better write down. You're going to have to do like a test talk to show how this will work. He's like, I get you, but trying to convince a bunch of different people who've never done this before to do it, that's going to be a challenge. I'm like, yeah, but it's a worthy challenge. That sounds really cool, doesn't it?
Yeah, totally. And you wouldn't, I don't know. That sounds a little tough to do in 5 minutes.
Not five minutes. It wouldn't be a 5 minute talk. It'd be okay. Like, it could be like 10, 15 minutes if you needed it.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Yeah. Sounds awesome. Seriously, let's see. Yeah, I'd be curious to know like what story you would use and whatnot. But you're bringing up like a general idea of like this is another product that you can have, and I think there's another dynamic that you're also highlighting as an example that there's part of that. So like the question is, how do you spread your work? How do you spread awareness of what you do? And part of that can be spreading awareness of you. And part of that is you're describing in a way another product that can come out of this, but it's also like a service. It's like, you know, you're performing a service. You're you know, doing a live reading or what have you, getting a public speaking engagement and, you know, making a performance out of it and whatnot. But part of that, an element in there is also that's sticking out to me is the venue, is you're bringing your work to a different place. And that different place has a fresh audience, or at least some percent of it is fresh and new to your work. So you're bringing the show on the road, if you will. And I do think like, that's one of the things that repackaging your work or finding that related separate work that can help sell one another, has that benefit if it's most likely being showcased in a different venue than the other work. Right. So you're doing, videos that go to YouTube or wherever, or
you're too cool for YouTube.
and, uh, or building an app and how you're distributing it in an app store. Well, that's a new venue. And with that comes, you know, new marketing challenges, because you'll have to spread awareness that you are in this other venue also.
You know, I haven't looked into this very much, but is anybody using the Newsstand app in iOS for distribution of comics? I'll have to look.
Checked. I'd assume, but
because that has the whole like subscription recurring payments kind of thing, which is, you know, for some the holy grail.
Yeah, it's got the subscription business model built right into it.
Yeah, but you're limiting yourself to iOS. But on the other hand, you know. So I think that's another thing to keep in mind too. But you know, I mean, I'm not enough in the webcomics world to even know what are the venues anymore. Like what, like 10 years ago, it was all, you know, like, well, there's these webcomics rings. Remember the web rings? Like,
oh, wow, a web ring takes me back.
Remember Lycos? I'm just going to start saying 90s internet properties to make Rob roll his eyes back with nostalgia.
I hear it. No, I'm seeing a movie poster for, Independence Day? And I'm hearing the band, The Prodigy.
Wow. Vivid recollections. But yeah, web rings. And then there were also different web forums for web comics where they would have like a leaderboard. Here's like the top 10 web comics of today. You remember this? And then it'd be like a top 100 web comic.
I used to put myself through that. It was, please vote for me so I get off the bottom of this pile.
Yep. Yeah.
Because it sucks to be on the bottom. And yeah. Yep. Yeah.
I was there too. I don't remember participating in those for very long. But anyway, it, at that time, this was before Twitter, before Facebook, etc. That was really the only place, those were only centralized places to get to discover comics. And it occurred to me very quickly as I was messing around with this, like, wait a minute, the only people who are probably looking at this site are other webcomics creators. And granted, a lot of them could potentially become fans of my work. You know, there's that whole, like, I could become the leader of a tribe kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It struck me that maybe this is something where, you know, we should throw in the caveat that we're a very specific kind of content creator where, yeah, something like Lean Into Art is sort of directed at people who either make content or want to make content. But the work I create as a content creator myself, really, I want it to be the entry level person's read, right? I don't want to be the cartoonist. Even though I think really hard about this stuff, I want it to be something that just the general public can check out and don't necessarily need to be a content creator in order to appreciate it. Right. Mm-hmm. So that colors our attitudes toward this is all I'm driving at. And so this whole idea of breaking out into other venues and getting your stuff seen by people who are not necessarily comics aficionados or enthusiasts is a good idea for us. But your mileage may vary depending on who you are and what you want out of the work. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since I mentioned him, mostly only other guitarists and only other guitarists of a certain type listen to Yngwie Malmsteen.
Yeah, actually. Yeah. He's not somebody that I see getting covered on The Voice or anything like that.
He's a character, though. I was seeing an interview of him. Anyway.
I don't know if there's any more juice left in that. Or do we want to get to takeaways? So we just do like a
Yeah, let's go to takeaways. I think that's it's a wonderful topic and it keeps on giving, and it has to do with a lot of really important things with how do you get your work out there? And, you know, clearly all of us are thinking about that quite a bit.
For sure. So it's something we can come back to again and again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to log into my Netflix real quick because one of my takeaways is I want to talk about something I just watched and I want to get the name right.
Oh, cool.
Come on.
I'm trying to think of...
About takeaways?
Yeah, I don't know. Like I've had, I've been putting a lot of time. I actually finally broke through the memory leak that I was having with Guitar Fretter.
Yeah.
Memory leak sounds, I don't know, does it sound like oozy or gross?
What, a memory leak?
If you focus on the word memory or the word leak. But yeah, anyway, there was a, I had that whole challenge of where I think when I mentioned a takeaway regarding Guitar Fretter last time, I think it was about having a, you know, just sticking to it and wanting to put that final polish on and holding, you know, not doing the immediate gratification thing and just releasing it right away. And part of, you know, I found a whole big, you know, thing I needed to fix with it, basically. And it had to do with a memory leak and how it causes a crash. So that's what a memory leak does for an application or a game where it's like all the enemies are coming in. And let's say the behind the scenes code isn't managing and cleaning up after itself enough. So after like maybe 1,000 enemies come in, the application never hasn't been a good citizen. So it's just been taking up more and more and more and more and more space until the operating system says, nuh-uh, crash. you sit down. and that's the ultimate fate of a memory leak is to crash. And so anyway, I worked through that, and that was satisfying. And that's kind of a whole long adventure as far as the different things I worked on to finally get to a solution. But I think it's worth mentioning. Let's see.
So wait a minute, how much time were you putting in after hours? Because I mean, beyond, you know, doing the day job and other creative pursuits, how much time does this app development stuff eat out of your evenings?
Well, I look at it as it's not a constant
sure
time, you know, that I dedicate. It ebbs and flows because I'll have, you know, other projects that I'll be focusing on at any one time. However, since this summer, I mean, the two main side projects I've been working on are, it's three. I mean, things we've been doing for Lean Into Art, but I would actually put that in third place as far as how much time I've been putting in on things. But then next would be Guitar Fretter. Then next would be the web design class that I'm teaching.
Right, you're teaching a class on top of all this stuff. Jeez, Rob. Why do you do this to yourself?
I think this is the creative challenge that I've chosen to take on.
Yeah.
This season.
Okay, I got to know. I mean, you know, you're several weeks in to this class now, and I bet it's just been flying by. I bet it doesn't seem like you've been doing it that long, and it's already like you're coming up to, you know,
almost over. And yeah, I mean, it's a major topic to sit down, and we did a big check-in as far as the different there is a final project and just making sure where everyone's at, where they're at. And of course, you know, I think a lot of time, I don't think this is bad. A lot of workshops and a lot of, technical talks and, learning experiences are very recipe focused, where they're focused on just one thing. And of course I want everyone to make their thing that is relevant to them. So, you know, that's a recipe for more complexity. But yeah, no, it was one of those things where we're like, oh man, there's not that much time left. And we did a lot of check-in to see where everyone was at. And, it was great. I think they're doing really well. And,
would you do it again?
Yes, I would do it again. I think it would be better. That's the thing where I always feel this apology in my heart for the students that are taking it the first time, because they are my beta testers.
Sure.
But and inherently there's going to be new things that come up with every new mix.
Every new mix is going to be different, Rob. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you shouldn't apologize for them being beta testers, because every class is a beta test, and it should be that way. Nobody wants to sit in a class where you come in and go like, all right, Bueller, here we go. I'm going to do the thing that I've done 1,000 times, right? You should be, improvising and reshuffling the cards with every group of kids, you know? Because every group of kids is a different dynamic. And I mean, when you do your second, third, fourth time around with this thing, you're going to see that. Like, it's be like, what was the secret sauce in this group that made them all so awesome? In this next group, there was that one kid just changed the dynamic so much, and it made my job so much more difficult. right? Like I had to work three times as hard to get the kids excited because of that one different little piece of the overall mix, right?
So. Yeah, and I'm definitely learning that as far as, you know, how do I mean, yeah, I mean, I've done, a growing series of you know, workshop experiences and whatnot, but they're so different compared to a long running course, right? I mean, a course that's running over 12 weeks is like way different than like a workshop that's even like 2 hours.
Yeah.
It's way different.
Workshops then of course, are one night stand, right? I mean, it's yeah. like you love them and everything, but there's ultimately very little consequence of this whole interaction. Whereas,
right,
I didn't mean to go there, but
you know, no, it's funny. Yeah, it's there. It is there. There's a it's a different relationship. The energy you can bring and all that to like this one time event, one time only, and then it's done. Yeah. It's different than when you're in the when you're in it for the long haul and you're trying to build something substantial.
Yeah.
This, the context of the metaphor and all this is extra silly.
Yeah. That's where I apologize. But anyway, you know, I mean, it's like, yeah, you know, that's one of the reasons I continue to do teaching is that it's been a lot of fun to roll those dice with every different class that I teach. And, you know, there's the class where here's three returning students and five new students. And here's one where it's all new students. And here's one that's happening in the summer. Here's one that's happening in the fall. How does that change the dynamic? And having to roll with that and never going in. And, man, you know, I think this really calmed me down quite a bit about life is that once I learned that I don't get to predict what happens today. I don't get to go in there and go, well, this is what we're going to do. I get to go in there and go, I wonder what we're going to do. You know, I'm going to try to go here, but they may pull me there. Oh, man. Once I learned to roll with that, I got hooked on that. I'm seriously hooked on that feeling.
And I totally, I think that makes a lot of sense not to, but we're working in little different spaces. So like the whole idea of, you know, building a, I mean, there's a lot of similarities, you know, don't get me wrong, but like building a website, I have a need to keep returning to some structures that I laid out in the syllabus. Okay. And also found it interesting to just try to use that as a consistent theme and spine for the experience that like, making sure I deliver on certain key skills. Versus, because I could easily see, you know, not landing on, you know, all the right, you know, and for instance, teaching hyperlinking, teaching, you know, basic HTML page structure, and then, you know, forgetting, and then teaching basic CSS, but then forgetting to teach, you know, including your CSS and an external page using, you know, the rel tag and all that. Easy to forget like something, cause it's such a long laundry list of things that and it's like, you know, being such a long course. So I kind of have this oscillating challenge back and forth where, we totally went off the syllabus this class, like just went, you know, and I do that. Some sessions are that, but yeah.
Yeah. Anyway.
There's a push and pull and back and forth because I would say I learned it from watching you with that, the joy of the very improvised classroom experience.
Mm-hmm.
So.
No, but you're right. But you do have to have some kind of a through line. Otherwise you're not really accomplishing anything. You're kind of like dilly dallying in a whole bunch of little separate pies and you need some kind of cohesion of the overall. There has to be at some point in the multiple week sessions where you go, and this is why you did this 3 weeks ago and this last week, right? Here's where I help you, or I hopefully lead you to understand the connections between these different things, thinking, linking, right? So yeah, definitely you need to do that. This is not just spinning around in your Mrs. Roper gown saying, just create everybody, right? So, well, cool. I'm glad you're having a good time with it, but man, that must be a lot of work.
It is, yeah, it's a lot of work. But you know, it's inspiring. I want to, you know, you meet a group of kids and you want to do well for them, make it the best thing, at least a good learning experience, you know?
Well, cool. I can't wait to hear what happens at the end of it. You know, like when the kids go off and which ones stay in touch with you, which ones, you know, continue to follow up with you years later. I bet you have an idea already who some of them may be, but that's part of the fun of it too.
Yeah, I do not have that perspective really of the repeated experience, right? Where you've been teaching certain topics repeatedly for years. And yeah, I mean, I don't know.
It was on my mind because I just got a message from one of my former students who's coming back to town because it's Thanksgiving weekend coming up. And so she's gonna be in town for a few days and wants me to look at some stuff that she's been working on. And
that's,
you know,
awesome.
I'll own up to it. I had this little moment of like, oh, she remembered the old man. That's so sweet. You know, of course I'll make time for you, you know.
That's super cool.
Yeah. It's always really cool. So, takeaways. I have a quick one. I'm concluding a project where I'm concluding my artist in residency at the University of Michigan. And I think I got like 3 weeks left where, for those who haven't been keeping track, I've been working on site in a studio on the campus of the University of Michigan for the Lloyd Hall Scholars Program, which they set up a really nice studio inside of a residency hall. So like the bottom two floors of this residency hall are all art studios and music studios. So like there's places to practice the piano and stuff. So like the whole bottom half of this building is all geared towards communal areas and creativity. And then the top floors are all the residency parts. So these kids are living in this building and then they've set me up in the building so the kids can have access to me anytime they want. Well, at least when I'm there. And I agreed to go in 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I was very excited about this, right? This is the opportunity to test drive a lot of ideas that I've wanted to explore for years. This idea of running a studio that people could just walk into. What would that be like? I think of a Main Street side studio where it's just me and a bunch of other artists just working on our work. And people can come in and they can just look over our shoulders and maybe we could do an impromptu workshop right off the cuff, you know, if enough people show up. Doesn't that sound like a fun idea?
Would there be coffee and rolls? Sometimes. I'm sorry, I'm just, it sounds awesome. It sounds flat out super fun.
There would be coffee and rolls, as a matter of fact.
It was my understanding that there would be punch and pie. Sorry for throwing you off. No, seriously, so a bunch of artists that energy where you're all working on things and all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, I need feedback on this thing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden that leads to like, you know, well, that reminds me of this other project. We got to pull in so-and-so because they did this really cool thing on, you know, yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So you'd have that. Yeah. And then also it'd be a way to advocate for your medium because you have an open door that the public can just come in and see the stuff happening. Right. Well, you know, as with anything, you know, you mentioned many times in the past, the Sun Tzu thing is like no plans survives contact with the ground or whatever. I've had a few hard learning experiences through this project. And one is that letting people come into your office to talk with you when you're working is not always a good thing, you know, because there were a few days this semester where I had kids in and out of that studio all day long and I didn't get much done that day. You know, it was fun. It was super cool. I'm glad that I got to, you know, introduce some of these kids to the medium of comics. Some of these kids had never read a comic.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, they didn't know, you know, what went into them or anything like that. And I think, you know, it was kind of eye-opening for them. They seemed genuinely entertained by the whole experience. Other kids had a middling interest but now are much more interested. Awesome. But I had a deadline to meet that day, and I didn't meet it, you know. I had to put in some night hours that night at home in order to get that done. So that's one, is that, you know, be careful what you wish for. I mean, there's been days where nobody comes in there, and there's days where just, like, a couple people come through. But you know, that is one of the dangers of having an open door, is that I learned that, yeah, I would have to completely rethink how my deadline schedule would work in that kind of environment. Two is it depends on the town you're in, because Ann Arbor is terrible for parking. And it's known for this. So this studio is not far from my home. I mean, it's actually like, you know, a quick bus ride. But if I miss the bus, that means I got to drive. And if I got to drive, that means I got to look for a parking spot. And there were days where, man, and I'm sure you're experiencing this because, you know, you just recently left, went from the whole working from home thing to working off site.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea of driving to some place and then looking for a parking spot and the dent that puts in your day, even if it's just an hour, that's a dent that's getting taken out of your day that you had before.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not glamorous. There are mornings where I'm driving around for what?
That's a great way to put it.
I'm trying to be generous with this because I mean, I have nothing but sympathy for people who have like a long commute. Yeah. But the other morning I was driving around for 45 minutes looking for a parking spot. 45 minutes looking for a parking spot. And finally I just was like, the tech with this, my time is worth more than this. I'm just going to park in a parking structure, pay $10 for the day. And not have to worry about this. Because the other thing was, is I was finding spots where it was like 2 hours. You can park here for 2 hours, which means now I got to set an alarm on my phone so I can go back to the studio, work for an hour and a half. Up, alarm's going off. Got to go move the car so I don't get ticketed. And I'm doing that all day long. But anyway, so the idea of working off-site is kind of cool in a way. But man, there are some trade-offs. There's some serious trade-offs. The idea of having to drive to some place and to negotiate some kind of parking arrangement. And, also, like, bringing your food and life with you, right? It's like, when I work from home, I'm hungry. I'm going to go upstairs and get something to eat. Then I come back down and I work again. Now I got to think about it. I got to be like, oh, well, let's see. It's going to be a 9-hour day. I'm going to get hungry around 2. I'm going to have to bring all this stuff. I'm going to have to bring a lunch. And I better bring an extra apple just in case. Oh, no, I didn't bring enough coffee. I don't have any coffee with me. I can't just go upstairs and make more coffee. Oh, being a grown-up sucks. I like staying at home.
Yeah, I know. Somehow you reminded me of Fred Flintstone heading to the mine, right? He had to bring his lunch and everything. You know?
Yeah.
Yep. It is funny. It's a huge, it's a very different workflow and different lifestyle, right? I mean, certain things as far as, yeah, how much time you spend in the car and what, I don't know. Like for me, I guess I listened to a lot of podcasts anyway, but yeah, I mean, commuting and thinking about like, well, what am I going to bring with me to listen and whatever,
yeah, that
way
kind of
to and from
too.
Work. Yeah, all sorts of little things. Yep. Your electronics, you know, am I going to bring my iPad or whatever? And,
well, that was the other one. Is
chargers.
Because even if wherever I parked, I would have a 15-minute walk from there to the office where I was working. And there were days where I was like, well, I'm going to need my graphics tablet. I'm going to need my tablet. And I'm going to need my laptop. Because there's different things and all of those things I'm going to be needing throughout the course of this day. Mm. Well, and that adds up to like 15 pounds on my back when I've got my thermos, my lunch, and you know all my power cords and everything. And now I'm walking up and down. Ann Arbor's very hilly. And I'm walking up and down these hills, and I'm like, this is the worst. I am so spoiled being able to work from home. You know, it's like, I'll just talk with everybody on Skype. I'm just going to stay home, stay in my office, and I'll just if I'm going to socialize, I'll do it on Skype. That'll be fine. So my point is for the folks who, for the listeners out there who do work from home, who think about that studio idea, I still think it's a great idea, but I want it to be within walking distance of my house. And if you're in a place like Houston, forget about it. Don't do it. It's impossible. You won't enjoy it because you're going to be on the freeway for 2.5 hours every day. That doesn't. Anyway.
No, exactly. Yeah. There's, some people have huge commutes and whatnot and, you know, more power to them. Some of them like it, you know, that's all right. But yeah, it's, there's huge things like, one thing I thought was weird working in a home studio is that the days when you don't talk to anybody. Yeah. Does that feel weird?
Yeah, it does.
And yeah, I mean, I don't know.
I do. Yeah, there were many days where, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I've gone the whole day without using my voice at all, and all of a sudden, I'll catch myself talking to the cat or something. Not like talking to the cat, like, hey Maggie, tell me about your day, but more like, hey, come on, like, out of the way, you know, get out of here, you know, and the cat's jumping on me or whatever. And I'll be surprised by the sound of my own voice because I just haven't used it in, you know, 10 hours.
Yep. Less
of a problem for me now because I'm always teaching or always doing some kind of audio thing. But yeah, the not talking to people and getting a little weird that way sometimes. This goes back to our topic, though. You know, another thing when we talk about, like, you know, process how-to videos, another thing that I'm going to beat this drum one more time, just very lightly, just one quick beat on it, is this idea of journaling your work through some kind of audio or video, either doing like a quick YouTube video or an audio podcast. And when I say journaling, I'm saying, like, don't even do, like, anything as elaborate as a how-to video, but just, like, here's my thoughts for the day. I worked on a thing. I'm capturing it. That's extra content that will let people feel like you're accessible as a human being, even if they're not your friend. Something Eli Nyberger has said in the Comics Are Great podcast many times is giving the appearance of friendship is critical to building and sustaining an audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some wisdom in there.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think if you consider it, there's a lot of byproducts or something that you could do that to generate that extra thing. And some of them are really, you know, expensive and hard to build and may seem, you know, far-fetched, but not all of them, you know. Do a little slideshow presentation using some of your art and post it on SlideShare and you know, with some interesting observations or something, right? There's just a ton of things worth experimenting with. And a lot of them, like when they're experiments, they're not going to be inherently, you know, hugely audience gathering in and of themselves, but you can get an indicator. You can look around. Like for me doing that first app, I knew I was going to stick with it, but that was great feedback, trying that new thing. Well, yeah, and making money off of something I made was very nice as well.
that always helps keep the fires going, right?
Yep.
You actually get paid to do something that you enjoyed doing. All right. Well, are we at the end? I think we're at the end.
Yeah, I think we've completed our path here for, what, episode 63?
63. So, okay. This one was like, again, we broke the format again. And I'm going to do a call to action to the listeners. And I think partially the break in format came out of a really interesting series of questions from a listener. By the way, if you guys have questions of your own that you want to send us, you can email us at leanintoart@gmail.com. But here's the preferred way to do it is go to leanintoart.com and use the contact form, because we specifically ask you on that form whether or not we have permission to read your name and read your email on the show. And we'd really feel better about responding to listener and viewer questions and comments if we have that explicit permission. So you go to leanintoart.com, use the contact form, click the thing that says, yeah, you can read my thing on the air. And don't forget to include your web address if you do that, so we can give you an actual plug on the show. Because other people listen to this, you know, it'd be a way to promote yourself. Don't just write to us to promote yourself, but that's a fringe benefit of interacting with a thing, is that networking angle. We got another email from somebody just the other day who was asking us, I think they just pretty much said, like, how do I get involved in this whole Lean Into Art thing?
Like, oh gosh, the very provocative question. And yeah, I can't wait to follow up on that one.
How do
I get involved in this Lean Into Art movement?
That's what it was.
Actually, yes. I was like, oh man.
Yeah. And you know, you do that by interacting. And when you interact, if you share the pertinent details of who you are, then we can follow up and find out more about you. Rob does his diligence. He'll look you up on LinkedIn.
Darn right.
Anyway, yeah, so that's at leanintoart.com. And there's another thing at leanintoart.com. This show is sponsored by the workshops that we host on the site. The way we cover our hosting costs and cover our time for putting together these topics and responding to the things, the interactions that we get, is by selling workshops. And we happen to be doing a sale right now called the Season of Creative Challenges. That's at leanintoart.com/workshops. Rob, you mentioned you're making video games from comics workshop. How much is that?
It's 10. $10.
$10.
Yep. It's over 50% off during this special or sale during the Season of Creative Challenges, in honor of all these different wild things, whether it's just your natural urge to, you know, overbook yourself doing stuff, or you take on one of these organized challenges like NaNoWriMo or, 24-Hour Comic Day or, you know,
30 Characters Challenge.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Less than a third of a parking ticket in Ann Arbor, you can get, and seriously, you can get an hour-long workshop with Rob where you learn how to make video games from your comics. Learn how you already have what you need as a, by making comics, you already have the chops that you need in order to make a video game out of that. And it all comes down to solving this thing called the fun loop, which you talk about extensively in that workshop, right? Once you understand the fun loop, you can build all sorts of games.
Exactly. I mean, so you can, we go through some experiments with extracting some dynamics from a story and then reusing that. So it's and it's about, yeah, exactly, establishing a fun loop. So it's about, it's a very game design focused and tying in your creative work in a non-interactive form, probably, you know, kind of doing comics, and then how do you take pieces of that and get a design concept down. And of course, there's examples that the students that who have taken it before have shared in the Lean Into Art forum as well.
Yep.
Which you get access to that by signing up for any workshop. And by the way, during the sale, signing up for any workshop gives you access to about 12 hours of bonus content, which is essentially spread across, what, 8 different sessions of things. 6 topics from the creative topic pack, right? And then 2, the keynotes, the opening and closing keynote from 30 classes in 30 days last year, which we did.
Yeah, and there's a whole bunch of really awesome stuff in there. Creating compelling characters with Tyler James. Creating crazy characters with Krishna Sadassian. That's a 4-part series. Foundations of Dynamic Line Work with Brandon Dayton. Introduction to the Super Rad World of Color by Kevin Cross. Coloring in Adobe Photoshop Elements with me, Jersey. So a lot of this, there's a lot of stuff in there, and it's all $10 and gets you bonus content, access to the forum, no DRM. And, you know, I think it's a great holiday gift idea, and it's a way to thank us for putting the show together every week. And then if, let's say, you say, I don't have even the $10 to drop on this because I just got a parking ticket in Ann Arbor after all. Well, I totally sympathize with that situation. So in that case, I would say tell a friend about the event at leanintoart.com/workshops, or you can go to iTunes and give us a star review. You know, however many stars you think we deserve, that helps more people find out about the show and the project itself. And that's totally free. Just take a few minutes of your time. You can even do it anonymously. So, or you just send out a tweet, leanintoart.com/workshops. Looks like some neat stuff here. Kind of cool. Mm. So with that, I think we can wrap.
And I just want to do a shout out, big thank you to Lean Into Art listener, Marshall Couture, because he's mentioned his support of us, which we appreciate it. And shout outs on his podcast, The Escape Artist.
The Escape Artist Podcast. Yep. And is that at plexhop.com? I know that's his website.
Yes, it is.
All right. Plexhop.com. Yes, thank you, Marshall. Marshall's been like a huge champion for the project, and we do need to acknowledge that. Also, you know, there's been a bunch of people who have been buying or purchasing, downloading workshops from us in the mm-hmm. last week or so. And thanks a lot to everybody who have stepped up and, you know, participated in the workshop section. Let us know what you guys think of the content that you find there. You can always participate in the forums. So mm-hmm. you get access.
And we have a rating, actually. We have a workshop feedback form. So essentially you can, you know, go there and capture your thoughts in a way that help us, you know, rate and critique specific aspects of the workshop.
Awesome. So yeah. So cool. Thanks for that reminder, Rob. Yeah, it'll be linked in the show notes, The Escape Artist Podcast. Marshall really embodies exactly the kind of person that we're trying to reach through this thing, right? Mm-hmm. The self-learner, the self-starter, the person who's ready to take it and run with it rather than just submit to the guru. So I'm not going to get tired of that.
Jersey's beating up the guru again. Nope.
All right. Well, Rob, thanks for, you know, improvising with me tonight.
I really enjoy it, Jersey. Thanks for tolerating improvising with me. I am honored.
All right, so until next time, everybody, thanks for downloading and listening. I have been Jersey Drozd of leanintoart.com and Jersey on Twitter.
And I have been Rob Stenzinger of interactive-storyteller.com and Rob Stenzinger on Twitter.
Okay. Pokemon.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. And remember, leaners aren't wieners. Thanks for listening.